Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. So you're on public transportation, and you notice a cute stranger. Usually, when you get to your stop, that's where the story ends. But for Rachel Newman, things went differently. Rachel's essay is read by Kelly McCreary, who stars in Grey's Anatomy on ABC.
I met him on the bus. The number 9 was my daily commute from the University District of Seattle to the Rainier Valley, where I worked in an overcrowded elementary school. Because I got on early in the route, I always settled in the back, a prime people-watching spot as we traveled through Seattle's varied neighborhoods. I was in the middle of a short-lived crafty period, and usually spent the 30-minute ride crocheting hats. But my crocheting patience was limited, and each hat emerged hastily, too small to fit anyone but a newborn. I didn't know many people in Seattle, and none with young children, so the hats accumulated in a teetering stack in my bedroom corner. I was always on the lookout for random babies to whom I could give them. When I wasn't looking for babies, I would stare at the back of the guy who regularly sat in the middle of the bus on the left-hand side. I never saw him get on, so I didn't know his face, but I had become acquainted with the narrow swath of neck between his Carhartt jacket and wool hat. One day, I looked up as he was getting off and caught a glimpse of him. He was gazing at me with an open, interested look that made me warm. I glanced away and went back to my crocheting. A couple of days later, the bus broke down. The driver got off and began pacing the length of the bus, arms crossed. Some passengers gathered their belongings and left. Others barely looked up from their reading. The guy with the Carhartt jacket and I crossed paths mid-aisle. He smiled, revealing even, white teeth. I smiled back. "What are you going to do?" he asked. I was still 20 minutes from my stop. "I think I'll wait," I said. "I've still got a ways." "What about you?" "I'm going to walk," he said. "I'm not going far." We chatted for another minute, and he gave me a casual "see ya" nod and got off. From the window, I watched his easy slouch to see if he would turn around and wave, but he didn't. I went back to my crocheting. The next week was my school's spring break, and I visited family. When I returned to work and my usual commute, the guy with the nice neck was not in his usual place. And he wasn't there the next day. Or the next. I never saw him on the bus again. A month passed, my bus rides continued, my stack of tiny hats was reaching epic proportions. One morning when there was a break in Seattle's spring rains, I walked to the corner cafe. Taking my place in the back of a long line, I picked up a copy of The Stranger, Seattle's free weekly newspaper known for its literary personal ads. The local custom, which I diligently followed, was to start reading the newspaper from the back. There, four ads down in the "I saw you" section, was this. "Stranded on number 9 to Rainier Valley one morning. You have short dark hair, a green hat, brown eyes, and work in an elementary school. I was late to work in Mount Baker. We spoke briefly. I haven't seen you since. Would like to meet again. Box number 7901. I snorted in surprise. Looked around to see if anyone had noticed. Then read the ad 3 more times. I gathered 2 copies under my arm and went home, coffee forgotten. That evening, I called the voicemail box and left a message with my phone number. His name was Jason. We met 2 nights later for dessert. When I walked in, the place was empty except for an old couple at a back table and a young guy with spiky brown hair drawing on a napkin. Without his wool hat, he looked barely old enough to have finished high school. I hovered, not sure if I had made a mistake. Then he smiled. I recognized that smile. I sat down, and he blushed, putting me at ease. We each ate a large chocolate mousse and then went for a walk in the nearby park. The talk was light, and the night was warm, but I was impatient. I wanted to get the talking over with and finally get a chance to kiss the back of his neck. At the edge of the park, we paused by my car. "Where are you going now?" he asked. "Home," I said. Another pause. "Want to come?" He took my hand, and there was no more talking. Even in the car on the way back to my house, even in my room, even when night threatened to turn into dawn and we finally fell asleep. In the morning, I had to rush to work and our goodbye was short. "I'll call you," he said, and I nodded. As I walked to the bus stop, I found myself skipping every few steps. I didn't know if we would see each other again, but it had been a good night. A few nights later, we met again. On top of a small knoll at an abandoned gas factory converted into a park, we had a conversation I'd had a few times before. "I like you," I said, "but I'm not ready for a relationship." This was my standard pain prevention opening line. "Me either," said Jason. "Let's just have fun." "Okay," I said. "Good." We stared out at the black water of Lake Union, our fingers casually interlaced. And we did have fun. A child of brutal divorce, I had decided early on that avoiding marriage would be a way to avoid at least some of the pain. So we kept everything light. I moved, and then he moved, from Seattle to New York, where we shared a big place in Brooklyn with a bunch of other people. We didn't think of ourselves as living together, just really good roommates. To pay the bills, he built sets for music videos, and I edited during the day and worked as a hostess at night. Before long, we had been together, casually, for 10 years. I was 30 and wanted to have a child, so we did. Nearly 4 years later, we wanted to have another, so we did. By then, we were living in Oakland, California. We had joined with another couple to buy a house, each of us owning a quarter share. Jason and I were doing just about everything married couples do, but committing to each other in marriage still seemed too scary and, we felt, unnecessary. More time passed as we supported each other through illness, the deaths of loved ones, and financial stress, and somehow we stuck to our agreement to keep it fun, if not always easy. Even when we were tired, broke, and cranky parents of small children, being together seemed preferable to the alternative. Around us, though, things were changing. Couples we had known for years were splitting up. Our daughters were old enough to fly across the country by themselves, barely glancing back as they boarded the plane. Though Jason still looked like a teenager, there were white hairs in his beard. A few months ago, as we were walking around Lake Merritt, just blocks from our home, we paused to sit on the damp grass. Jason pulled a newspaper from his backpack for us to sit on. "Look what I found," he said, "all the way from Seattle." was a copy of The Stranger. I turned to the I Saw You section, and there, in the center of the page, was a large boxed ad. I saw you 20 years ago on the bus to Rainier Valley. We spoke briefly. Will you marry me? I read it again. Well, I should have hugged him or burst into happy tears. Instead, I was silent, filled with something like dread. After 2 decades of a relationship founded on serendipity, a public long-term commitment seemed like tempting fate. When Jason and I met, we stayed together because we kept waking up in the morning wanting to be together for another day. But now the stakes were a lot higher. There was no way at this point to cut my losses without cutting off a huge part of myself. A fat Canada goose waddled over to us, nosing at my legs for a handout. Holding the newspaper, I looked at Jason. He smiled at me, patient and easy, his teeth as white as the day we met, despite his drinking coffee every day. Such is his luck. Okay, I said, reaching for his hand. Yes. Because maybe he is right. Maybe committing to each other in public is finally worth risking and worth planning. After all, we've been good together for 20 years, 3 moves, and 2 children. We ought to be able to survive a wedding.
That's Kelly McCreary reading Rachel Newman's essay, Waiting Patiently for the Wall to Crumble. We'll catch up with Rachel after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
When we caught up with Rachel Newman, one of the first things she told us was that the beginning of her relationship with Jason, 25 years ago now, was all about serendipity.
So the ads in The Stranger ran for a week, just a week. And, you know, back then, you had to put it in the mail. Like, you took out the ad and then you wrote it down and then you sent in a check. For a while, I was always suspected him of having put in an ad every week. But, you know, as far as I can tell, to this day, it was the only ad that he put in. And this was 1990-something. There was no internet. There wasn't, like, the ad stayed anywhere else. So it was entirely the length of the line for coffee that made me pick up the paper. And if one other person had just decided not to have coffee, it probably wouldn't have happened.
Rachel's essay was published in 2014, and she says she sat down to write it because she was struggling with a question.
We had agreed to a wedding, but I noticed that I was still in turmoil, and I felt a little silly. Like, why was I nervous? What was all this about? This is somebody I'd known for 20 years. It wasn't like some guy on the street on Tinder. You know, he was like, it was in my house. He was taking care of our children. And yet I had all this anticipation and nerves and wonder if I was jinxing everything. And what I realized in the writing of it was that my heart was engaged and committed and that I was going to get hurt no matter what, you know, in life, that that wasn't really something that with all my skills and protection that I could control. And so in a sense, the writing of it was for me a love letter to him in that I'm taking this risk, even though I know in one way or another I'll get hurt.
In October 2014, Rachel and Jason did get married, kind of.
It was such a glorious celebration. I think having a wedding where your children get to be there was, for me, like one of the most wonderful pieces of it. We had the wedding on my younger daughter's birthday. She still says it was the best day of her life, as does my older daughter. And then afterwards, someone asked me about the actual marriage piece, and I realized we hadn't done it, and we hadn't signed anything. Were we supposed to sign something? We jumped in the ocean, and we'd put our hands in mud and put rings on our fingers, and what else were we supposed to do exactly? And so it turns out that there is paperwork that you do when you get married, and neither of us knew whose job it was to find it. And so I said, if it's on me to do it, it's not going to happen. And so far it hasn't. So 5 years later, we have not done any paperwork. So apparently we are not married, though we did have a wedding. And we can now say it's been a quarter of a century of living together. We have managed to avoid all paperwork.
So even though their marriage isn't official, Rachel says she's glad that she and Jason took a risk together.
I hope that people reading this will choose loving bigger and loving more over protection, and know on some level that that is the biggest way you can protect yourself, is by risking your heart over and over again in public, kind of. I think that was the most wonderful part for me, in a way, was writing the essay, but which was putting it in public, and then having the huge party, which was just saying loudly and unabashedly, like, I choose this and I want this, and whatever happens, that's true.
That's Rachel Newman. She lives in California. She's a writer, book publisher, and meditation teacher. Her books include Not Quite Nirvana and I Am Hope, Portraits of Immigrant Teenagers. More after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
One thing I love about this story is that Jason is such a romantic, and the idea that these two people who seem to not want to embrace commitment and to not want to do typically romantic things, like the idea that he would place not one but two ads in The Stranger, first to find her and then to ask her to marry him, is just sort of over the top. And I loved it. And, you know, they sort of think, that marriage, the official act of marrying and officially committing, is going to somehow put too much pressure on their relationship. And so they just were happy to sort of amble along, waking up each day and say, sort of saying, we're going to commit to each other again. But the combination of having that attitude and at the same time being incredibly committed and incredibly romantic, I just thought was irresistible.
And here's Kelly McCreary.
The moment of the story that really grabbed me was the proposal. I did not see that coming. It caught me totally by surprise. And I just loved that. It's so reflective of life. You know, a lot of things come and catch you by surprise, things that are going along one way and you think you understand them and they seem predictable and comfortable and easy, and then comes and grabs you and it makes your heart grow and expand and brings tears to your eyes and your life changes in ways you didn't imagine it could.
Thanks again to Kelly for reading this week's essay. You can see her now in Grey's Anatomy on ABC. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Additional help this week from Catherine Brewer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at The New York Times. Additional music courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And by the way, my other job is hosting an NPR show called On Point. Check it out in your podcast feed. See you next week.